Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change and how today's choices will affect tomorrow's community. This program is an extension of Action for Healthy Communities, an organization committed to identifying and carrying out projects that will improve the quality of life in San Luis Obispo County. The show's topics and guests focus on raising public awareness through credible and valid information about local and regional concerns, and is made possible through underwriting by Joan Giller Sargent. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. Well, the 2016 elections are over for the most part. The good news is the ad campaigns, robocalls, and mailings have finally finished, but a number of people are asking, where do we go from here and what happens next? My guests joining me for today's discussion are Dr. Mike Lattner, Associate Professor with Political Science at Cal Poly, Jan Marks, Mayor of San Luis Obispo, Stephen Nuno, who is Associate Professor in Political Science and contributor at NBC News Latino, will also be joining us by phone in just a little while. And today's show is live, and we invite you to also join our conversation with your comments and questions. And you can do that by calling us at 805-781-3875. I'll give that to you again. It's 781-3875. We had our producer reach out to a number of individuals for today's show as well, and for either call in or for guests. And many of them were either unreachable or could not come to the show. But we did have some interest, and unfortunately. And fortunately, Jan Marks, you were able to be here today, and we really appreciate that you are here today and really wanted a local perspective, too. And we did get a response from Lois Capps as well, and she sent along an email that she wanted read, that after a long and challenging campaign season, we have our work cut out for us to stand up for the priorities and ideals of the Central Coast and heal the divides in our nation. But our nation is strong, and I'm hopeful that our elected officials will be able to put aside the partisanship and divisive rhetoric and come together to best serve the American people. I know that Congressman-elect Salud Carbajal will continue to be a leader for the Central Coast and work to protect the values we hold dear. It's a great feeling to leave the district in such capable hands, and I look forward to seeing him and others to work together to keep our country moving forward. So, you know, with that in mind, what we're going to talk about today is just that. How do we look at what happened, and how do we continue to work together to keep our country moving forward? And Stephen is joining us by phone, so I'm going to bring Stephen online. Stephen, are you there?
Hi, yes, I am.
Hey, thank you for calling in and joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. And I don't know if you were able to hear the whole introduction, Stephen, but what we really want to focus on today is kind of what, not only kind of an overview of what happened, but where do we go from here? And I'm going to start with you and Michael. Kind of as kind of a wrap up of, you know, what occurred and what were the, obviously there were surprises.
That's an understatement.
And I think those surprises were for everybody. It wasn't just one or two people, and it wasn't just one party or a specific party. So let's talk a little bit about what occurred.
Sure. Well, political science as a discipline is always a good whipping post after every election, in particular this election, in that many people are accusing the pollsters of being wildly off. I think that that's not exactly the case. Indeed, if you look at the national polling averages, they were pretty much on. It looks as though Hillary Clinton's going to win the national vote, possibly by more than any previous electoral college loser since all 50 states have been voting. Where there were some systemic polling errors, I think, were in particular in the Rust Belt states, where there was a it looks as though undecideds either tilted towards or there was an increase in white rural voters that benefited Trump. But it's important to note that Clinton also underperformed relative to Barack Obama in a number of big urban centers in Detroit and a number of other important urban counties. And Stephen can certainly speak to some of that. But the while everyone was surprised, I don't think that one can indict political science as a discipline for not getting it spot on.
And so when you say underperformed, Mike, what are you contributing to that?
She didn't do as well among African Americans in urban centers, and generally, young people, millennials, did not turn out and support her at the levels that Obama was supported in 2012.
Okay, and Stephen, from the perspective of the of the Latino voters, were they as engaged and as influential in this election as was anticipated?
Yes, absolutely. Here's the thing: many people think that Latino voters are supposed to be influential, but somehow kind of have some high expectations of where they might be influential. And I mean, there's not a whole lot of Latinos in Georgia or North Carolina or Michigan and Wisconsin. So, they are beholden to the coalitions that are established in those areas, and they're definitely a part of those coalitions. But it looks as though they were overwhelmed by other voters in other parts of those states. However, when you look at states where there are a significant number of Latinos, like Arizona. So Arizona, the difference in voting between Democrats and Republicans was about 9% in 2012, and that went down to about 4 or 5% in 2016. So Latinos are influencing the outcome, but they are still just a minority. And so the big victory was Arpaio was voted out. He's the kind of the nefarious sheriff, country's strongest sheriff and against immigration. He was voted out in Maricopa County,
right.
Arizona. Hillary Clinton won about 90,000 more votes in Maricopa County than Obama did. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Trump lost 10,000 votes in Maricopa County that Romney got compared to Mitt Romney. So we see where there are Latinos, they are coming out to vote. About half of the Latino voters who participated in early voting. So they were motivated. They got out there, but still Latinos are a minority, and they're going to, if there you have a lot of voters coming out in some of these other places by other groups. Like we saw here, they're going to get overwhelmed.
Yeah, I think that's actually one of the larger stories of this election is mm-hmm. that while in California, and Stephen did his stint as a resident of California, he's a native, the Latino population really became a really crucial voting bloc in the 1990s. And today, as I think we witness by seeing things like the California State Assembly, the Democratic Party now has a supermajority in the State Assembly. They are a crucial voting bloc in the state, and you simply can't perform well if you don't perform well among Latinos. One of the things that we're starting to see nationwide, particularly in the Southwest, is this increasing relevance and importance. And that's not to suggest that they're a homogenous voting bloc, but their relevance is gaining.
One of the things that occurred to me off and on through the election process was there was so much seemingly to me of stereotyping of Latinos, of African Americans, of whites, as though as a block they all vote in one direction or another. And do you see that as having been something that really was had an impact too, of people missing the mark?
Oh, I don't think you can separate the content of the Trump campaign from the mobilization of Latino Americans across the board.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, racial division was very much a part of this presidential campaign. Mm-hmm. The language that Trump used coming out the gate with regard to not just Mexicans, but immigrants more generally.
Did segregate.
Absolutely, yeah. And made division a central element of what this presidential campaign was about.
And yet there are Latinos that voted.
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, and again, we ought to move away from thinking of any racial group as a homogenous voting
right.
group. Although, to the extent that the parties and candidates divide along racial lines, you can expect to see racial bloc voting.
And what you're in Arizona, Stephen, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
and so, what are the misconceptions about Latinos as a voting group that you encounter?
Well, I mean, like I said, I mean, many times people think of Latinos as this kind of monolithic voting bloc. You know, it was interesting how, just to give you a kind of a counterexample of Latino voting is in Florida, right? And so in South Florida, Cubans voted for Donald Trump at about a 50% rate. And so
yeah.
Latinos were important in Florida, and
yeah.
They were important for the Republican Party. So it's not just, one party that is dependent on or relies on Latino voters.
Mm-hmm.
Republicans are very comfortable reaching out to Latinos in certain areas around the country. So I think one of the misperceptions is that Latinos are these kinds of Republicans, but don't know it, right? That's another thing. It kind of gives this impression that that they're kind of ignorant about the political landscape. The diversity of voting shows that, they're well aware of their interests. They're well aware of the way the parties, reach out to them. The messaging, all of that is effective to them. A lot of folks think that because they're Catholic, they're necessarily going to be more conservative. Latinos in general, their approach to government is different from other conservatives. It's different from other religious folks, and so they do have an outlook on the government that they want a more active government, and that's because they're generally poorer, generally younger, and they want solutions that come from some government. Government policies that are going to help them, whether it's health care, loans for education, et cetera.
Now, with regard to the difference between the electoral and the popular vote, Barbara Boxer recently started movement toward trying to start legislation of eliminating the electoral vote. How reasonable is that? I mean, do you really see that's a large hill to climb?
To move that through the Senate is what we would call a Sisyphean task. It's not going to happen simply because there's no reason why we would expect small states to give up the systemic advantage that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And while it is certainly the case, and I think we're likely to see this actually exacerbated over future presidential elections, that now the divisions, the systemic advantage that the Electoral College gives to smaller states is now a very specific advantage to white rural voters.
Right.
And now we have seen this political alignment, particularly in this election, but I think it's probably going to continue, that the Electoral College will have, in essence, a racist outcome to the extent that it is now mirroring the political divisions in the country. And so while I think it's absolutely important that people fight and organize to change the Electoral College, it's not going to happen through a constitutional amendment. There are other ways around that. And so there's a national vote, which is essentially an interstate compact that California has signed on to, New York, Illinois, a number of large states have signed on to, not surprisingly, that would essentially guarantee that once 270 electoral votes worth of states signed on to this compact, that all of the electors from their state would go to the popular vote winner. And so there are ways of getting around the constitutional amendment, but it's going to be an uphill battle.
Do you think that given the results of this election with the disparity between the popular vote and the electoral vote, that gives it momentum for states to enact that?
Absolutely, and it should. I mean, Republicans are punished in the state of California because of the Electoral College, and so there is some room for organization there, although my sense is that until it happens to a Republican candidate, that is, a Republican candidate for president wins the popular vote but loses the Electoral College, if that happens, then we will see movement.
Okay.
Right.
In your perspectives, in recent history, say the last 75 years, has there been this kind of reaction to a presidential election that we're seeing?
We've never had a presidential election like this in
my
lifetime.
This is an unusual one. But in terms of a president-elect, I'm trying to recall when I've seen it. And I haven't. I can't recall. Has there been in recent history?
I don't know. Stephen, what do you think of what are some of the more controversial elections? I really don't have a
historical perspective. I know with Lincoln and during the Civil War, yes, but...
Well, with Reagan, there was a I think perhaps because you're in California, when Obama was elected, there was a severe reaction.
Was there?
Elsewhere, yeah. In the states that really objected to his policies and his race and...
And his legitimacy.
And
right?
His
let's not forget that this is
that's true. I'm forgetting
Donald Trump,
that because I kind of discounted
began
that.
Began to mobilize his coalition.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was definitely controversial, but maybe not in California. So that maybe that's why you didn't feel like you've experienced it.
Which is going to bring me up for my other next bubble, but I want to reintroduce you're listening to Central Coast Voices here on KCBX, public radio station. You are, if you just joined us, our topic today is November elections. Where do we go from here? My guests, Dr. Mike Latner, Associate Professor of Political Science at Cal Poly, Jan Marks, Mayor of San Luis Obispo, and Stephen Nuño, Associate Professor in Political Science and Contributor at NBC News Latino. Today's show is live, and it is a great time for you to call us with your comments and questions to join the conversation. You can call us at 781-3875. One more time, that's 781-3875. So, what was kind of missed here in California? Did the results of California kind of take what polls predicted they were gonna do, or was there something that was shocking here?
Well, Hillary Clinton actually overperformed slightly relative to the polling averages. And we knew Democrats were going to do fairly well, which they did. They captured the two-thirds majority in the state assembly. There are still several outstanding races that we don't have final results on. But it wasn't a sweep. So some of the close races, for example, Darrell Issa's seat, Congressman Darrell Issa, who was one of the main prosecutors in Congress, with regard to the Benghazi committees and other investigations of President Obama, held on to his seat narrowly. But it was a mixed bag. There were several seats that Republicans held on to.
Mm-hmm.
But, clearly the Democratic Party is the dominant party in the state.
And people really kind of see California as being kind of this area unto itself. Is that a misconception or...
It is in some ways. I think that it mirrors what is eventually going to happen to the Republican Party nationally. So starting in the 1990s, the GOP in California was disproportionately under the influence of a very culturally conservative group of statewide leaders. They used race and these culturally conservative messages for short-term advantage, for example, the passage of Proposition 187.
Mm-hmm.
And that served them in the short term, but it ended up costing them a lot in the long term. It's one of the reasons why they are basically a marginal party in the state now. And I think that while this may be a fairly disruptive election and we now have this unified GOP government, my sense is that over the next few election cycles, we're going to start seeing problems, right? I mean, the fact is that Hillary Clinton did win the popular vote. The fact is that the Republican Party lost seats in the House and in the Senate. And so we're starting to see transitions in states. And I think Arizona is one state to really keep an eye on.
Mm-hmm. Why is that? Stephen? I didn't know if you passed out when you heard Arizona. Or?
Yeah, well, not only in Arizona, but also, I mean, we once used to think of states like Colorado and Nevada as purple states, and we keep continuing to see trend where they become less and less purple and more blue. And that same trend is occurring in states like Texas. So, again, Hillary Clinton got more votes in Texas than Obama did, particularly amongst Latinos. And so you see Latinos having an impact even in solidly red states like Texas and Arizona, and those trends will continue as, you know, about 47%, almost half of the Latino population are millennials. So they're still very young. They don't have the same resources that that older folks have. And as they get older, they're going to continue to have an impact in the elections. We're already starting to see it in Arizona at the local on the local level. We saw a Senator Matos in Nevada win the election there. The trends are continuing and are following kind of California's lead, and we're going to continue to see that.
When you say purple states, can you please define what you mean by purple states?
Well, we break up states into the media breaks up these states into red and blue states, right?
Right.
Meaning majority Republican states, which we call red,
right,
and majority blue states, which we call which are Democratic states. And these states that are solidly red, like Texas, if you mix red and blue together, it's purple. And so we see a lot some of these states that were solidly red becoming more. And remember, California used to be a very strong Republican state as well.
Yes.
Prior to the 90s, and that's changed. But again, it takes time for these, mm-hmm. for these changes to happen. But the same trends that we saw in California 20 years ago, we're starting to see already in Arizona and Texas.
Uh-huh. Okay, we're going to take a call here from Bill. Bill, are you there?
Yes.
You have a comment?
Yeah, I would like the guests to comment on whether or not they think that the disabled vote could have put Hillary over the top. Neither candidate courted us, and we're the third largest minority group in the country. And I think Hillary could have baited Trump into dissing more of us than he did. And we vote.
Mm-hmm.
What happened? I never saw Hillary with her arm around a person in a wheelchair.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Although I'm not certain that Donald Trump would need any more baiting to insult any more people.
Well, that's true.
However, this is actually a question that that goes back to the issue of voter access and providing greater access to voters of all kinds and reducing the barriers to turnout that that many people face. Formal as well as informal barriers, and I think you're right that
I've voted in every election in the last 30 years from a wheelchair.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And everybody else can do it too.
Or a mail-in vote.
Yeah,
sure, yeah. Sure. I think that's one of the issues, frankly, that that the Democratic Party, if they're looking down the road to recovery, in some sense, that they do have to rebuild this big coalition, and certainly. Being cognizant of all the groups in their coalition is going to help them down the road.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's an issue that relates to health policy, obviously, as well.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I think it's very
Thanks.
Important.
Thank you, Bill.
Sure.
And we're going to take a call from Dave here. Dave, are you there?
Yes.
Hi. You had a comment?
Yes. You know that there was a question as to whether or not there was ever a Republican that lost due to the fact that he got the popular vote but not the electoral vote. And I believe that Richard Nixon lost to John F. Kennedy in 1960 in that fashion.
Right.
But I think that's one of the reasons that I was brought familiar with that a long time ago. But, since this last election, it seems like everybody has hopped on this question, but it's really it was something that the Founding Fathers thought through because they had to have a way to have the smaller states have a voice. The least popular state, the least populated states would have a voice in the government. And if the game were changed, then all of the marketing activity, that is all of the campaigning, would just be done in the major cities and go to the population centers. Certainly, if Donald Trump had played the game and he knew that it was a popular vote, he would have just marketed himself in the major cities, and who knows how it would have come out then. So you can only second guess, like, Monday morning quarterbacking to decide how it came out. But the reality of the situation, we are a republic, not a democracy. And we assign electoral people to vote for us, so we get the distribution across the country, and the smaller states like Ohio, ones that are so important, an important role, too.
We're not a direct democracy.
But, we're not a direct democracy.
Right. That's what Barbara Boxer now is trying to approach by saying that the Electoral College should be abolished. So we'll see what happens.
Right. So she would have to answer to those other states. What would they do then in that case?
Stephen, you were going to say something?
Yeah, when immigrants take the naturalization test, they have to take a citizenship test. And I think there is a question that asks is what kind of government we have. And the answer on that naturalization test is we are a democratic republic. So we are a republic. We're the type of republic.
We're a republic.
Is a democratic one.
Yep.
Well, yes, I agree that. Go ahead, Mike.
No, go ahead, Stephen.
When we look at places like with the Electoral College, I mean places like Wyoming that have about the same population as average some cities in California. I think that's a question that we have to answer as society is the same distribution of electoral votes that were determined in the 1700s, in the late 1700s, with agrarian farmers. Obviously, slavery had an impact on the interests of how these votes were distributed as well. I think the question that we should have a discussion on is whether or not that same same metric should be applied to today.
Well, I just like to say that with the Constitution, the every state's got two senators, and then the Congress is distributed according to population, and that's check and balance. The problem with the Electoral College, as I see it, is there's no check and balance. There's nothing like one-for-one or two-for-two representation on the part of the states themselves, if you know what I mean. So to me, it is really outmoded. But Professor Lattner, I know, has a strong opinion about this.
Yeah, I would go even further than that. I think, first, with the distinction between a democracy and a republic, that there's some misunderstanding in language there. When people talk about democracy today, we typically don't mean direct democracy like we have in California. We typically mean representative democracy, and that's what a republic is. When we talk about the world's democracies, we're talking about countries like the U.S. and Britain and Sweden and those countries that have representative government. With regard to the Electoral College in particular, though, I think one of the most nefarious elements of it is that we are now living in a system that is biasing representation in the same direction through many institutions. And so Mayor Marks mentions the Senate. So California gets screwed in the Senate because we have 40 million people and we get the same number of representatives as Wyoming, where mm-hmm. there are fewer people living than in Orange County, California. And so there's malapportionment that causes that gives an advantage to white rural voters in smaller states. The House of Representatives itself is malapportioned because Wyoming, even though it's 1/70th of the size of California, we still only get 53 3 seats, and when we should have about 70 seats because the size of the House of Representatives is capped. And then you've got the Electoral College that works in the same direction, and it's biasing representation towards white rural voters. And to the extent that our political alignments, that the shift fits those institutional advantages, that is going to cause increasingly unstable politics. And I think it's we need to revisit the question. In fact, at the Constitutional Convention, the direct election of the president was voted on and supported in a number of committees, but it just wasn't practical for all the reasons that that Stephen mentioned earlier. To centralize votes in the 1780s would have been a difficult task to coordinate, but there's no reason why we can't do it today.
The other thing that we can do is one of the suggestions that I've seen out there is increase the number of congressmen that are out there. There's nothing in the Constitution that says we have to have 435 representatives. So why not increase the number of representatives out there so that we can have greater access to those who are representing us? That's that would be a solution worth looking into as well.
Absolutely, yeah. The size of the House was actually capped, I think, in 1914 at 435 people.
Interesting.
Yeah. Right.
And it was arbitrarily capped, or it was capped because of a percentage or a ratio?
I think they were just running out of room to put the desks in.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I think it's the facility.
Seating chart cap. We're going to go to Rosemary here. Rosemary, are you there?
Yes.
Hi, you had a comment or question?
Well, just on the very last comment, gerrymandering has a lot to do with what representatives represent each individual states, and that's been hijacked by parties recently. So that's why there's more Republican representatives in the House but what I'm calling about is the immigrant story. I came to the United States when I was 5, did not know any English, did not even speak the language till I was at least in second grade and know what I was saying. But by fourth grade, I really knew what was being said on the playground, and it was dirty Mexican, go wash yourself. And I knew that I had had a bath and that I was not dirty. So I ended up getting into fights in the fourth grade. I mean, roll around on the ground type of fights with torn uniforms, bloody noses, hair being pulled out. And it was in response to these, remarks said to me or my little sister. And, of course, I was the only one punished. The blonde, blue-eyed Susies who, called the names, they were never punished. But I was always told, we're going to tell your father, who was, of course, a stricter disciplinarian than the nuns ever were. But at least my dad listened to both sides. And he was fairer when it came to punishment. And instead of a spanking, he gave me one of the most valuable lessons I've ever learned, and that was, you cannot tell somebody you're not a dirty Mexican and have them believe it. You have to show them. Be good at something. Excel in something, and you will succeed. And you hold your chin up, your shoulders back, and you will not be a dirty Mexican anymore in their eyes. And that's what I did throughout my life. I was good at memorization, so I could memorize the times tables and, all the prayers. So I was really good at spelling, and I was the last one standing at spelling bees, the same person that they had just called a dirty Mexican. So it gave me pride. My dad was the first social justice person I ever met in my life, and he was the first feminist because he had 4 daughters, although he would have loved to have had a son. Mm-hmm. He was blessed with 4 girls, but he used to tell us, you can be anything you want. And that's a big power to a child
who
has been maligned in their young years and traumatized by verbal abuse. And I don't want children to be abused any longer. This election gives me a lot of fear
that
children, again, are going to be victimized by words.
Yeah.
Words that hurt.
Rosemary?
And even though I learned the sticks and stones thing, I said it, but I didn't ever believe it. Yeah. It hurt to be called.
Rosemary, Jan wanted to say something to
you. Oh, no. I was going to ask you how you felt about the election, but then you went to it yourself,
right.
So I don't have to ask that question.
Okay.
Yeah. No, well, I think...
I'm very fearful for minorities.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yes, I have learned English. Yes, I have gotten an education. So now I just feel that this is going to happen again. I mean, this was in the 1940s and 1950s that this happened to me. And now I just thought we'd never see this again.
So,
and I fear
Jan, here's a question.
How do we protect our children? How do we empower our children?
Mm-hmm.
What can parents say to them now ahead of abuse so that they have some confidence in themselves, some empowerment?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what's your answer to that, Jan?
Well, what I want to say is I want to echo what Bernie Sanders said. At least I heard him on the radio coming over here.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, and this is what Hillary Clinton is saying, too, is that we're not going to abandon our progress toward establishing a non-discriminatory society, and we need to band together. I got an email today from a good friend who's an attorney in Santa Barbara, Jana Zimmer. I don't know if you know her. She was on the Coastal Commission. She's a good friend. And I'm also an attorney, and I've heard this from a number of other attorneys saying, you know, we need to band together and make sure that we are very alert and do pro bono work to help people with their, if there's any violation of their constitutional rights or their rights under the laws of non-discrimination and affirmative action, we need to double down and get in the trenches and not be complacent and be alert and vigilant. And that's definitely what I plan to do.
Thank you. So
I think that we can't give in to fear. It's important to feel it and articulate it, know it's there so that you don't just glaze over. But at the same time, it's a wake-up signal that says, yeah, okay, that's why we have to just get stronger.
Yes, I know. I received a visceral reaction that made me ill the first couple of days, actually ill.
Yeah, me too.
And then I realized I can't stay here. This isn't a healthy place to be. I still need to listen to the news. I need to know what direction so we know where we can react and where we can be knowledgeable on where to be
and how,
be stronger and have our voices heard.
Right. And Rosemary, how you can stay engaged.
Mm-hmm.
And to stay engaged, yeah.
Correct. Yeah. Well, thank you for calling.
Okay.
Bye. You're listening to KCBX, your public radio station at 90.1 FM, San Luis Obispo, 91.7 FM, Salinas de Paso Robles, and 89.5 FM, Santa Barbara, and streaming at kcbx.org. The election results stunned many in our nation. But the results are in, and the question on the minds of more than a few citizens is, where do we go from here, and what do I do personally? Today's guests are offering some of their own post-election thoughts and comments. I'm joined today by Dr. Mike Latner, Associate Professor of Political Science at Cal Poly, Jan Marks, Mayor of San Luis Obispo, Stephen Nuño, Associate Professor in Political Science and contributor at NBC News Latino. And you can add your voice to our conversation by calling in at 781-3875. Again, that's 781-3875. And, you know, I think when Rosemary was calling in and saying that her concerns or her response was visceral, it's not uncommon, I think, from what I'm hearing from people, from both sides of a spectrum. It's not just unique to one group of individuals, that this is really a time where people are really not sure where we're going and what we're kind of headed into. It's unknown seas.
Yeah, I think the organization that we're seeing in the streets reflects that fear as well as anything. And often that fear will spill over into violence on occasion. I know that my own experience as an educator, I have Middle Eastern students and Jewish students that have expressed, mm-hmm. Real fear about the direction that this administration is going to take. And I think that the message there is that it is a wake-up call. And this is not a Republican or a conservative or liberal issue. This is a question of human rights and basic decency, and we've got to put our shoulder to the stone, and we're going to help our new president make wise decisions. I hope. Mm-hmm. I mean, the bottom line is that this is the new regime that we live in, and we all have a responsibility to live up to our obligations as citizens.
Well, I think what you're saying too, Mike, is that we can't just live in a bubble. You know, we can't just say, "Well, mm-hmm. I don't like it. I can't do anything about it." We really need to find a way to remain, as we said to Rosemary, engaged.
Yeah, I'm going to, go back to the days of Ronald Reagan when he appointed a Secretary of the Interior, James Watt, I believe. And Reagan had always said, if I've seen one redwood, I've seen them all. There's no particular reason to preserve the redwoods, right? This is when he was governor. So then he appointed somebody who believed in the second coming. And as the Secretary of Interior, he said there is no reason to conserve the natural resources because when the second coming happens, the whole world's going to get destroyed anyway.
So why waste our time?
So that was during the time that the environmental movement got stronger and stronger. And so partly in response to this kind of really destructive and fatalistic kind of message coming from the top. So I think that I have great faith in the American people, and I think that no matter who Trump appoints, it's not going to be enough. How do I say? The influence will not be enough to overcome all the years of progress and the important values that the American people have. And so we're just going to have to double down and roll up our sleeves and fight back.
Do you think it's important that we as Californians also engage the rest of the country? Because there is, I have lived, honestly, I've lived in the South. Mm-hmm. So it is different.
Oh, yeah.
We are different here. And, and you pointed that out to me. I mean, I was here in California when Barack Obama got elected. And prior to the election, I went back to visit my daughter who lives in Texas. So it's a very different place, but we can't dissect ourselves. It doesn't seem to me that's been healthy.
Well, I'd just like to add that my husband's parents immigrated here from Germany because of Hitler. They're Jewish.
As did mine. Yeah.
Ah, okay. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that Jana Zimmer pointed out to me, and she actually is a refugee from, I believe, Czechoslovakia, but she was born in a displaced persons camp during the war. And at any rate, was that the lawyers and the judges and the priests all caved in to Hitler as he was coming to power. So the church, both the Protestant and the Catholic Church, were solidly in the Nazi camp, as were all the lawyers and all the judges.
But there was a very different economic time during that.
I'm not saying that we're in the same situation.
Yeah,
what I'm saying is that those entities and communities really need to stand up for the values that we have, and I think they will. I think we will. I think we're going to find the faith communities coming forward, the legal communities, and all the other, in terms of the environment, the alternate energy industry, all of the and we haven't talked about climate change, but I don't think that we're going to just say, oh, all right, game over with climate change. No.
So let's take a call here from Sue. Sue, are you there?
Hello?
Sue?
Hi, my name is Sue.
Yes? Hi.
Hi. I had a question about Bernie Sanders, and I'm a lifelong Democrat, and I've always really admired Bernie Sanders. But at a certain point during the primary, after it was determined that he was not going to be able to catch up to Hillary because she was really winning in the popular vote, that was when he pivoted and started to really attack her and the Democratic Party as being corrupt. And he was saying that he was even saying they need to be investigated. And I've talked to a lot of women now post-election who are very angry and feel like he really did a lot of damage. Because, I mean, don't get me wrong, I love his ideas. I feel that the Democratic Party actually already was trying to do a lot of the stuff he was saying. And I'm glad that he brought the young people along with him. But when he didn't, when he kept attacking her and the Democratic Party for being corrupt, and his reasons for saying they were corrupt was that they were using a system that they had also used under Obama and John Kerry, but he decided now to attack Hillary and Debbie Wasserman Schultz. And so Trump started to use his words against Hillary. So mm-hmm. for those months that it dragged on after it was already clear that Bernie was losing, she was being attacked from both sides. And when you have someone on your side attacking your person, that's very damaging. And so I don't think that, I mean, I would have voted for Bernie if he had won. You know, I would have put my issues aside as far as how I felt about that. But I don't think Bernie realizes that there's a lot of women, including my 28-year-old nieces, who are very upset. And we, anyway, so any comments on that?
Well,
can I agree a little bit? So, there's reasonable people can disagree on the impact that Bernie Sanders had on Hillary Clinton's vote. I tend to be sympathetic to that sentiment for one reason, and that is that Bernie Sanders made an appeal to a constituency that largely cost Hillary Clinton the election. Right, you have these voters in rural places like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and in Michigan. That really, felt many of these voters liked Bernie Sanders. And in fact, when you looked at Michigan, Bernie Sanders beat Hillary Clinton in mm-hmm. Michigan, and that was largely because you saw a lot of these, these labor union men that felt that Bernie Sanders was speaking for them, and Hillary Clinton wasn't. So I think this is all speculative. We a lot of people say, Joe Biden should have run, and he would have talked to that same constituency in a better way than Hillary Clinton. But I think that should also kind of force us to kind of look at how we're evaluating our representatives or those that are running for us. I think Hillary Clinton did pay a price for being, a woman. I think that many of the influences that propelled Bernie Sanders was because Hillary Clinton was a woman. I was saying in March, April, that Bernie Sanders had lost. He knew he had lost. Mathematically, it wasn't going to happen. And perhaps had he dropped out in April, he wouldn't have had, mm-hmm. 2.5-3 months of negative campaigning against Hillary Clinton. I think that's a good argument. It's also speculative. I mean, nobody knows what the future might have been had he dropped out. I think that is an argument that that has some weight to it.
Well, that's very, I have to, this is Jan Marks talking. I have to say that I hear what people are saying about that. And I personally supported Hillary Clinton, but I would have voted for Bernie very much like our guest here. But now Bernie Sanders is a really important voice and power center in terms of what happens next. And I feel that it's really important not to disrespect Bernie Sanders. So we really need to get behind him. I do have to say there are many factors that came to play with Hillary Clinton. I have personally feel that there was complacency that was created by these polls and the media report that, she's going to get it. So people didn't feel motivated or mobilized that, hey, we have to really get out there and walk the streets for Hillary Clinton, because there was a kind of a complacency that was. And then this whole FBI stuff that was really dirty pool. I mean, so, you know, there are a lot of different factors. But I just want to say more power to Bernie Sanders. We need him. We need Elizabeth Warren. And we need to put our differences aside and really move as one as much as we can.
Yeah.
Yeah, I will agree, although I will say and just reemphasize that when an election is this close, mm-hmm. everything matters, right? Mm-hmm. So you can point to anything,
right.
particularly in the Rust Belt states, right? The barometric mm-hmm. pressure may have contributed to the outcome, or left-handed black men didn't turn out at the levels that we expected them to. I think there probably is something to complacency. There's almost certainly something, at least a point and a half, with regard to the FBI mm-hmm. Email controversy, mm-hmm. and so it's hard to point to any one thing. You can pick your pet cause for why you lose, but I think there's also some at least marginal indictment of the Democratic Party. The fact mm-hmm. that
yes.
Bernie did speak to an older, broader coalition that the union white guys that used to be the base of the Democratic Party. I think that there is something to be said, mm-hmm. and something that deserves criticism in the Democratic mm-hmm. Party, that they have moved away from that.
Well, mm-hmm. And the takeaway is, what do you learn?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Because you can't go back and fix it.
No, but we can step forward
right.
and decide not to pick each other apart. I mean,
yes.
The circular firing squad is something we need to avoid.
Exactly. Terry, are you there? Terry?
Yes, this is Terry.
Hi, Terry. Did you have a comment or a question?
I had a comment, and I may be a little out of sync now. I was listening to you when I was driving, and now I'm in my office. But when you were talking about the movement to abolish the Electoral College, there is an alternative, and Maine and Nebraska have both taken that alternative. And the states have the right to apportion the Electoral College. And right now, only Maine and Nebraska are doing that. I know you have some constitutional scholars there with you.
Uh-huh.
I'd be interested in their opinions as to whether any state other than Maine and Nebraska would have the bipartisan ability to actually take the chance on apportionment as opposed to winner-take-all, and just like to kind of kick that back around again.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Very interested in the conversation.
All right. Thanks, Terry.
So that's a fantastic question. In fact, my colleagues and I, we finished a book on gerrymandering in America this spring. We just calculated, Alex Keena, actually one of my co-authors, calculated the congressional vote and estimated what would in fact happen if we allocated electors by state, by congressional district. And if we did that in 2016, even though, again, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote, Donald Trump would have won the Electoral College by that method as well. Not only that, but in 2012, Mitt Romney would have won had we used that method.
Hmm.
And the reason that is because congressional seats are gerrymandered, and they are biased in a direction, in particular in the Rust Belt states, where you have in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, states that are very competitive in terms of presidential races. But the GOP took two-thirds or nearly three-quarters of some of those seats in this election because those seats are so gerrymandered. And that's not to suggest that gerrymandering is not bipartisan. It is. The Maryland congressional districts are heavily favored toward the Democratic Party. So whichever party is in power will do it. But for that reason alone, I would say that would be an awful solution until we fix the problem of gerrymandering.
So we have – we could go on, obviously, forever, but I want to talk about with the election, what does it mean for us locally? What are some of the concerns, or what are some of the just be aware of things that people do need to remain engaged for mm-hmm. and with and going forward that we want to keep our attention to? You
right.
mentioned environment, Jan.
Right. Well, climate change is something that California is very, very much, committed to fighting. And here in the city of San Luis Obispo, that's a big priority. So assuming that I am on the city council next time, which is the votes are still being counted.
They're
so
still being counted in your race. I know.
And it's within a few hundred votes. Is that right?
350. I'm 350 ahead. And
so don't say your vote doesn't count.
No, so every vote counts. But assuming that I'm there, I when we do the budget goal setting conference, I definitely want to make better implementation of our climate action plan and also updating it a priority. And I think that also needs to be done countywide so that we're in closer sync with the state. The state really has definitely asserted leadership, and however, it's a worldwide problem, so we need to also make sure that Donald Trump and his cohorts don't weaken the accord that actually today they're meeting in Marrakesh. We need to make sure that we keep, as a nation, that we keep climate change right there at the forefront, and I think we can do it. I think there is a good chance that we can turn it around. So,
Stephen, what for you do you see as some of the challenges, or do you think that we really need to be attentive to, and what do we as individuals need to do as we go forward?
Well, the Democratic Party has made a decision 4 years ago, right, to kind of hitch their future to a coalition of white progressives, minorities, single women, or women, and they have to. I think a place like California, which is now California and New York, kind of like a shopping mall, right? They kind of anchor the country on either side of the country. I think needs to put in a greater effort into these other states like Arizona and even like Milwaukee and Michigan. I mean, Michigan was decided by 10,000 votes.
Mm-hmm.
That could have been influenced with a little bit more resources from states like California and New York, who could have helped these minorities to come out and vote. There's, 800 fewer precincts out there to vote. And so, this is a very achievable thing for progressives. But I think there just needs to be greater investment. Also, one of the things that I've been heartened by is that, as a legacy of the civil rights movement and as a legacy of World War II, right, is there's now in place a lot of institutions that are designed to help fight these types of battles. These institutions didn't exist, right, in the past, but now they're here and they've been around for a long time thanks to the Democratic Party, thanks to progressives, thanks to many of the folks who came from Europe as a consequence of World War II. And so kind of doubling down and dedicating ourselves to these institutions, because mm-hmm. They're very important, whether it's the NAACP, SPLC out in the South, MALDEF, the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund. All of these institutions have been in place for now decades, and so these are the institutions that the Democratic Party needs to reinvest in.
Well, I want to thank my show's guest today, Dr. Mike Latner, Associate Professor of Political Science, Cal Poly, Jen Marks, Mayor of San Luis Obispo, and Stephen Nuño, Associate Professor in Political Science, contributor at NBC News Latino, joining us from Arizona by phone. We'll be taking a break next Thursday to celebrate Thanksgiving with family and friends. I hope no matter what differences this past campaign, as we gather with family and friends and associates, we can find areas of strength and commonality to build on. And hope you're able to find ways to do that. This has been Central Coast Voices, sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities. We'll be back the week after Thanksgiving. Thank you for joining me on Central Coast Voices.